words by way of introduction. The whole book of Judges, and this Tribble takes, in this book, she's looking at sort of some of the worst stories against violence against women in Scripture. And it's no accident that two of them are from the book of Judges, because the book of Judges does have a great deal of violence in it. Not just violence against women, but the whole story of the holy wars, the conquest of the land as the people of Israel were moving from the wilderness into Palestine, the way they took over the land, killing very, very many people in the whole process. So there's a great many stories of violence in Judges. The other one that Tribble looks at is in Judges 11, the story of Jephthah's daughter, how he kills his daughter because he thinks he's made a vow to God, saying that he would sacrifice her, whoever was the first one that he saw when he came home, and it was his daughter. So these are just two stories out of many stories of great violence. The whole book of Judges is written from a perspective of highlighting the violence and anarchy at that time, because the author, the narrator, is trying to argue that Israel needed a king. And so this story in 19 is going to start with that little sort of editorial remark. These were in the days when there was no king in Israel and everybody did whatever they wanted. That's the way the book of Judges ends, with that same thing too. Everybody did what they wanted because there was no king. And that remark is liberally thrown in throughout the book. And as we read it, there definitely is a sense of violence.
Is that chapter 19 of Genesis?
No, of Judges. Did I say Genesis? Mm-hmm. Judges 19.
Judges. Chapter 19 of what?
Judges. Judges.
Oh, Judges.
That would be a whole other, probably weeks worth of sessions if we got into the whole, the question of holy war. How could God justify the incredible violence that took place as the people took the land and all that. And there are some interesting tapes in our tape library. Charlie Mays especially has a really good one on holy war that I've used before. But anyway, today we're just going to look at this one story of violence specifically against this woman. Because I think there are some special problems when you look at the stories of women and judges that are not resolved by that, by getting a king. I mean, even in getting a king in Israel, bringing more order and rule to the land is not going to solve the kind of problem that is taking place in this story of this concubine who was raped, murdered, and chopped up into pieces. Before we begin, there's also the question that Tribble takes up of why remember these stories, why study these stories. They're fairly, for most of us, obscure stories that we don't look at often. And I think that she's very convincing in saying we're not going to solve anything by really in terms of, I mean, we can ask questions about where was God in all this, what is God's role in the people's history that this kind of thing happens, but that ultimately it's just to remember an important part of our history and to remember these women who suffered such. And she'll make the case, I'm going to finish by reading a quote here from her that I think is really good, that we need these stories to remind us that this kind of thing is still happening in other ways and to resolve to work against it. But anyway, she tells these stories in memory of these women, and this is probably one of the saddest that you'll find anywhere in Scripture. So let's begin here. Judges 19. Let's see, how about if somebody would read 1 through 9?
In those days when there was no king in Israel, a certain Levite was sojourning in the remote parts of the hill country of Ephraim. He took to himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. And his concubine became angry with him, and she went away from him to her father's house at Bethlehem in Judah, and was there some 4 months. Then her husband arose and went after her to speak kindly to her and to bring her back. He had with him his servant and a couple of asses, and he came to her father's house. And when the girl's father saw him, he came with joy to meet him. And his father-in-law, the girl's father, made him stay, and he remained with him 3 days. So they ate and drank and lodged there. And on the fourth day they arose early in the morning, and he prepared to go. But the girl's father said to his son-in-law, strengthen your heart with a morsel of bread, and after that you may go. So the two men sat and ate and drank together, and the girl's father said to the man, be pleased to spend the night, and let your heart be merry. And when the man rose up to go, his father-in-law urged him till he lodged there again. And on the fifth day he arose early in the morning to depart, and the girl's father said, strengthen your heart and tarry until the day declines. So they ate, both of them. And when the man and his concubine and his servants rose up to depart, his father-in-law, the girl's father, said to him, behold, now the day has waned toward evening. Pray, tarry all night. Behold, the day draws to its close. Lodge here and let your heart be merry. And tomorrow you shall arise early in the morning for your journey and go home.
Okay, so the scene is set up here. You don't really need to know the geography, just to know Ephraim, where they're from, is the north. The young woman is from Bethlehem in Judah, which is the south. It's rather surprising that she, being a concubine, becomes angry and has the power to leave and stuff. But anyway, she goes home. And her husband, it's interesting the way it goes back and forth between husband and master in this whole story, misses her and wants to go after her to speak kindly to her to bring her back. And so he journeys then down to the south, down to Bethlehem, to seek her back. And what do you think about the way he does that? I mean, the narrative here, I think, is curious. But it's a whole interchange between him and her father, right? The two men having fun together, but not a lot of mention of her, right?
It reminds me of my wedding, where my father said, who giveth this woman? And my brother handed me to her. You know, I belong to the men in my family, and now I belong to my husband. It wasn't my thing to do at all. It was between the two men.
Huh. Anybody else?
Would that be unusual in that society, the men?
No. It's also interesting the way it shifts back and forth from the singular to plural here. Notice verse 8, I mean, he's going to go home with his concubine, but on the fifth day he arose early in the morning to depart. He's the one who's making all the decisions about when they're going to go and all that kind of thing. She really has very little role in this, no role at all.
The only thing I was thinking of as I was reading this, I'm not part of those, but it seems there's a concerted effort on the part of the father of the girl for some reason. It's not just, perhaps, you know, there's some things going on in the relationship before she came home, and she tells him, and he has some concerns about her going, so this is a way to do something. I'm not sure, but it seems that it isn't normal. It's a very concerted effort, almost deceitful.
And you think that might be for her sake? That's a good point. Okay, well, let's keep going.
You sort of wonder that, as he said, just because, you know, they've already been married. Okay, so it's certainly not, you know, in the sense that he's trying to win over the son-in-law to take the daughter. I mean, he's right there to take her.
Right.
So it isn't doesn't come from that perspective. It does almost seem like from the other perspective that maybe there was a problem, maybe it was in relationship to drinking, who knows, and he drinks too much and he's trying to check this out.
He doesn't want to drive him home.
But he's spending a lot of time.
But I mean, you know, but how does the man get when he does it, consume a lot of liquor? So
I think it was a drinking problem. I think that's clear. No, you're right, and it's deliberately ambiguous, but it does seem like there is some concern on the part of the father.
Isn't it possible the father just doesn't want his daughter trotting back off to Ephraim again? I mean, that's a long, long ways away. Maybe he's just trying to keep her with him as long as possible, just because he knows when she goes back, it may be a long time before he sees her.
Whatever it is, she is not mentioned. but it could be because of her. I mean, I think that's a good point. All right, let's keep on going here. Who would like to read 10 through 21? Whoever wants to read this part better really like to pronounce names.
I'll read it.
Okay.
But the man would not spend the night. He rose up and departed and arrived opposite Jebus, that is Jerusalem. He had with him a couple of saddled asses, and his concubine was with him. When they were near Jebus, the day was far spent, and the servant said to his master, "Come now, let us turn aside to this city of the Jebusites and spend the night in it." And his master said to him, "We will not turn aside into the city of foreigners, who do not belong to the people of Israel, but we will pass on to Gibeah." He said to his servant, "Come and let us draw near to one of these places and spend the night at Gibeah or at Ramah." So they passed on and went their way, and the sun went down on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. And they turned aside there to go in and spend the night at Gibeah. And he went in and sat down in the open square of the city, for no man took them into his house to spend the night.
Do you want to keep going?
I'm sorry. And behold, an old man was coming from his work in the field at evening. The man was from the hill country of Ephraim, and he was sojourning in Gibeah. The men of the place were Benjamites. And he lifted up his eyes and saw the wayfarer in the open square of the city. And the old man said, "Where are you going, and whence do you come?" And he said to him, "We're passing from Bethlehem in Judah to the remote parts of the hill country of Ephraim from which I come. I went to Bethlehem in Judah, and I'm going to my home. Nobody takes me into his house. We have straw and provender for our asses, with bread and wine for me and your maidservant, and the young man with your servants. There's no lack of anything." And the old man said, "Peace be to you. I'll care for all your wants. Only do not spend the night in the square." So we brought him into his house and gave the asses provender, and they washed their feet and ate and drank.
So far we've had sort of two incidents here of hospitality. It's obviously hospitality was a really important priority, and you can see there's implicit condemnation of the people who were unwilling to take this man in. There was an understanding that if someone was sojourning in your town, you should take them in. And the irony here is that they decide not to go to Jerusalem or Jebus, which is still a Canaanite city. That had not been taken yet. You can see the conquest is sort of a little by little, and that was not an Israelite city. So they don't want to go there to stay, but rather to Gibeah or Ramah, and go there, and then can't find anyone to take them in. And this is sort of a contrast with the hospitality that the father-in-law has shown here. But finally, this old man from the north takes them in, and well, this line, they wash their feet, they eat and drink. What do you notice, or what else is in here?
It's rather interesting that he had with him a couple of saddled asses and his concubine, the order of mention.
Well, she's another possession.
Could you tell us what the legal position of a concubine was at that time?
Well, I don't really know. Tribble says it's basically like a slave, sort of, just sort of one notch, but I mean, I can read you what she says. But he goes back and forth here with the father-in-law. Husband is, and sometimes he is called her husband, and sometimes he's called her master, but she's always called the concubine, never his wife. Legally and socially, she is not the equivalent of a wife, but is virtually a slave secured by a man for his own purposes. The grammar, it's okay. A man, a Levite sojourning in a remote country, took for himself a woman, a concubine. He is the subject, she the object. He controls her. How he acquired her, we do not know. That he owns her is certain. So, but I mean, so whether there was a marriage or not, we don't know.
Of course, the Israelites had male and female slaves at that time, with the rules all specified in their books.
Even if there had been a marriage, the probably the main difference is that any any offspring would not be legal heirs to any property, at least not in first place, as opposed to those of a wife. I think that would be one of the differences, right? Even if there had been some sort of ceremony of marriage or whatever, which they seem to allude to by using the word husband rather than simply masculine.
I don't know how significant it is, but I'm just curious that this old man sojourning from Gibeah also must have a house then in there. I mean, sojourning from Ephraim has a house there. He must mm-hmm. have two homes or something. Because as a preview to the story coming up, he's saying, don't stay in the square. As soon as this story starts in just a few seconds, he seems to be perfectly aware of what the intentions are for the men who are coming to the house. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what this word sojourner means for him at that point. He certainly must be well acquainted with the whatever is going on in that town and the attitude of the people.
And he's staying there.
He must have a home.
Yes.
Bringing people into his home. Mm-hmm.
And he obviously knows that it's not a safe place to be overnight. And he was obviously right from what happens later on.
Didn't different tribes wear different attire also, so that, oftentimes if you were Benjamin, you probably had some distinctive attire as compared with someone who lived in Ephraim. And there's a sense in which you can tell whether indeed the person is one of yours or not. And maybe that's some of the reasoning behind, and the Benjamites were not very hospitable toward Ephraimites. Who knows? I don't know what all that,
know that
is, but that might be another part of the whole picture that's there. And now, because they make this big thing about this man from Ephraim being there, and he's the one who invites him in.
I know that about attire. It's interesting.
Is there some significance to the fact that these are Benjaminites? What does that mean?
I'm not sure there is up until this point. What it means is that they're all going to get killed, basically, but then they come to chapter 20. I don't know of any sort of previous thing of saying that Benjaminites tend by nature not to be hospitable or anything like that.
Abraham's blessing on the tribes was really a bad one for the Benjaminites. He said that they were going to be ravenous wolves or something like that.
Okay.
I can't remember the exact words.
That would be Genesis 14.
Mm-hmm. Does have significance just in terms of what Mark earlier this morning, Edward was saying, that it has a lot to do with the conflict between the tribes of Israel, the chaos at the time, and the fact that the author of Judges is trying to say, this is why we need a king. So to identify a tribe here as opposed to another tribe and the conflict between the two is significant in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
Jed, that reference was in Genesis 49:27.
Yeah. Benjamin is a ravenous wolf, in the morning devouring the prey, and at evening dividing the spoil. Yeah, when Jacob goes through all the tribes and blesses them, it's hardly a blessing. Yeah, and that's, like Barry said, I mean, obviously there was chaos ruling the land. That's how all, chapter 19 begins. In those days when there was no king in Israel, and that already we know, okay, something bad is going to happen, because this author's purpose is to show how terrible things were until there was a king. And this is probably one of the worst stories you find. This is the end of the book of Judges. This wraps the whole thing up, how the tribes are going to go to war against each other, basically, even. And the idea being that some of that would be solved when there was a king. That's how the book is going to end also. So there's definitely chaos here.
Well, this man is a Levite, so obviously no love lost between the Levites and the Benjaminites.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting that he is a Levite, because we'll see how wicked he is. And the Levites were supposedly sort of above the others, meaning they were the holiest of the people, and from the priestly class. And he is clearly going to do a terrible thing. But just to note here, he's already, I don't like this guy, basically. Tribble doesn't either. I mean, he's already in verse 19, look at, he's gone to get this woman back. I mean, he missed her, he loves her. But the minute there's any kind of question about whether they're going to get hospitality or not, he's already saying, your maidservant, for example. Is he offering his wife to this man already now? I mean, why doesn't he say my wife or my countrywoman? Instead, he says your here. In 21, it's interesting again that it's the singular. So he brought him into his house. It's really the man, the old man is offering hospitality to the man. And the tragedy of this story we're going to see is that the rules of hospitality are very, very strong, that you must take someone in, but they don't seem to apply to women. This woman is betrayed by the very people who take her in. And there's, if the rules of hospitality are so important in Israel, they don't protect her. And it's already the switch here to the him, so we brought him into his house.
Let's go back to that comment about maidservant. I'm not sure that's legitimate. He's talking about me and your maidservant and the young man with your servants. In other words, I am your servant, and this is your maidservant, and this other young man is with us, your servant. So he's not distinguishing, he's not saying your maidservant, he's saying we are your servants.
Okay. But he's speaking on her behalf and making sense. Yeah, you're right. There is a okay. All right. Any more comments before we get to the beginning of the sad parts here?
I don't want to read into it, but just continuing on that hospitality thing, I think what comes up very early in the story when we read on, that hospitality was offered by I assume another Levite to another Levite in the Benjamin area. And the first requests coming, as we read, are going to be from the for the man, and which is not what I would call hospitality there either. So I'm not certain the Benjamin aspect of hospitality is a differentiation between male and female. Right. Certainly the Levite, the old man Levite, his response is
And the implication here is the Benjaminites were bad hosts anyway, because one of them should have been willing to, he passed by Jerusalem in order to be with one of his own people. The Benjaminites were considered to be one of your own people. I mean, they are Israelites, but yet they wouldn't take him in. And so that's a condemnation of them already there as being bad hosts. Yeah, you're right. All right, let's keep going here. 22 to 26, who wants to read?
As they were making their hearts merry, behold, the men of the city, base fellows, beset the house round about, beating on the door, and they said to the old man, the master of the house, bring out the man who came into your house, that we may know him. And the man, the master of the house, went out to them and said to them, no, my brethren, do not act so wickedly, seeing that this man has come into my house. Do not do this vile thing. Behold, here are my virgin daughter and his concubine. Let me bring them out now. Ravage them and do with them what seems good to you. But against this man, do not do so vile a thing. The men would not listen to him. So the man seized his concubine, and he put her out to them. And they knew her, and abused her all night until the morning. And as the dawn began to break, they let her go. And as the morning appeared, the woman came and fell down at the door of the man's house, where her master was until it was long.
Okay, comments?
I think that it points out the importance of hospitality on the, you know, that his job, once you are in my house, I am there to protect you. Okay, and he's willing to do anything to protect his guests. It's the you know, the main intent of what he is doing. He'll give his daughter, his concubine, he'll give anything to protect her.
But he wasn't willing to go out himself, you know, I mean, so he wasn't willing to do anything to protect his guest. He didn't say, well, I'll come out and you can abuse me, you know. He was only willing to go as far as sending his daughter or the concubine out, so that wasn't really willing to do anything.
Well, we don't know. Maybe if it would have gone that far, he would have been.
Now, what about the fact that he had two guests, though? I mean, the concubine was also his guest. She too was sojourning, and yet, so I mean, I think here the fact that your male guest is protected, you'll do anything for the man who is visiting you, but no protection for the woman is really pointed out that distinction there, because she also was his guest. But it's already been set up in verse 21, so we brought him into his house, that it is the man who is considered to be the guest who gets that protection of hospitality.
Sort of hard and almost sick to try and differentiate between wrongs here, but it could be that homosexuality was perceived as the worst wrong in his mind or the other thing, in the mind of all the people at the time.
Well, that is an interesting question, because, I mean, there's an obvious parallel to this story in Genesis that is often used as a text against homosexuality. Everybody, the story of Lot, right, which is almost identical to this, although there are some important differences there. Genesis 19. Just to recall that one, it's the same interesting situation that Lot is sort of a sojourner in the land where he's living. I mean, he too, but he has a house. I mean, he lives there. He's a resident alien or whatever. And these two men come to visit him, and the men of Sodom say, let's see, I'll just look at that one. Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may know them. Lot went out of the door to the men, shut the door after him, and said, I beg you, my brothers, do not act so wickedly. Behold, I have two daughters who have not known men. Important difference there. I mean, here it is Lot offering his own daughters, whereas in this story in Judges, he's offering the guest, basically, the concubine.
Right, my translation.
Well, he's offering his daughter, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's offering his virgin daughter and the concubine. The one who goes out is the concubine. And a lot of people have used Genesis 19 as a text against homosexuality, but most scholars now would say that that isn't the issue here. And even when you look at scripture itself to see what the sin of Sodom was, it's not homosexuality. It's the lack of hospitality. It's the fact that of betraying someone who was your guest.
I want to point out one thing, though, in verse 25. But the men would not listen to him, I assume the master of the house. But the man, who I'm assuming is the guest, mm-hmm. would not listen. But the man seized his concubine. Mm-hmm. So what did the master of the house do with the concubine? The man,
okay,
the husband.
You're right. The master of the house offers the concubine and his daughter, but it actually is her husband, the Levite. This guy I don't like.
I don't know about modern scholars, but over the ages, sodomy hasn't been used to refer to lack of hospitality.
Right, and that's a word in the English language. Do you think, though, I mean, I think what we have to do is to find out what the sin of Sodom was, is not just to assume the fact that because we have a sexual act that we have named sodomy, that means what is going on. I don't know, what do you think? So you think that it is the homosexuality issue that's...
I think that's quite possible.
That was what these men came and asked. They asked in both cases for the man first. Right?
Mm-hmm.
They didn't say, we saw you with a beautiful girl, mm-hmm. or such and such, mm-hmm. or we know you've got two daughters or something.
But I think the other part of that is that if the man goes out, then these possessions go out with him. You know, that's possibly the other part of it. So you not only have the man, but you also have his possession. When whatever happens to the man, yeah. in Israelite society, that is also almost determinative that also will happen to his possessions, that you also control his possession. If you control the man, you control his possession. So if the man goes out, you know, then it would seem to me that there would also be a sense in which the concubine, the virgin daughter, you know, you get the whole shooting match at once.
I think here, I mean, too, that most people now would make a distinction, I mean, that rape is not a sexual crime as much as it is an issue of violence. That these guys didn't really care who they were with. They were happy, apparently, to have a woman or a man to continue there. What they wanted to do was commit an act of great violence against this person. And I do think that there's been a tendency to misinterpret these stories as a condemnation of homosexuality, when clearly the fact that they were willing to to rape the daughter or the concubine is not, is an indication that they weren't homosexuals.
But, I mean, the host said, you know, tried to reason and said, hey, we'll give you the virgin daughter and the concubine. And no, they wouldn't listen to reason. They really did want the man. And so it wasn't that they were dissatisfied with any, you know, form of sexual deviation. They really, you know, their first choice was the man in both stories. In the other stories too, in the Sodom and Gomorrah, they wanted the man. And when they said, take our virgin daughter, they really, they didn't want to make that bargain. So I don't think we can say that they were willing to have, you know, any way to, that wasn't their first choice.
And even though the possessions might have gone out with the man, it specifically says that the reason they wanted man was sexual, not any other reason.
Sexual violence, though.
Right.
And they wanted to rape.
So I believe that he probably knew. And this wasn't something that nobody knew about, and it seems that it's saying that he let the concubine go out because to save himself.
The interesting thing seems to be that indiscriminate sex with any woman who is not actually a married woman, and even in some cases, even Abraham's actions with Sarah, that was a perfectly accepted thing, but there was this great horror of homosexuality by some of these.
Well, okay, I think it's unfortunate here that the issue of homosexuality gets played off against this terrible crime against the woman that ultimately resolves here, but I think it is really important because our culture has been, because we've been so anti-homosexuals to really look and see if that's the issue here. I just picked up a commentary on Genesis this morning, but this is by Walter Brueggemann. We also could look at Von Rad's commentary on Genesis or a number of other ones. And he's talking about that, the passage with Sodom and Gomorrah here. But it's obviously very similar to this one. And here's what he says on it. The Bible gives considerable evidence that the sin of Sodom was not specifically sexual, but a general disorder of society organized against God. It is likely the interpreters will disagree about the sin of Sodom, but the evidence in any case shows that the Bible itself did not agree that the sin was homosexuality. It may be that sexual disorder is one aspect of a general disorder, but the issue is presented in a way not pertinent to contemporary discussions of homosexuality. He goes on to say the issue is hospitality, it's violation of hospitality. So more and more, commentators say that homosexuality is not what these pastors are about, even though that's the way we've read them through the centuries.
But it's interesting that shift in interpretation has also accompanied the general shift toward a more acceptance of the role of the homosexual portion of the population.
Clark, mm-hmm. There's several different levels here that concern me, I guess. First of all, I think it's really pretty perverse, and I'll use that word intentionally, to take a story where you start with the possible sexual violence against a man, and then that becomes the woman becomes a substitute, and to say that because it's written in the Bible that one sin was replaced another, that means that one is worse than the other. It is really sickening to me for us to sit here and simply imply that raping a woman is less of an evil than raping a man. The other thing is that, for me, it is a matter of saying that in this society, the man simply had more power. When you have a choice of what you're going to pay for a certain, either buying something or that you're going to give up for certain kinds of punishment or any way that you can get out of something, you're going to pay what is least valuable. And in this particular case, it is the woman, his concubine, that is the least valuable. It's a matter of bargaining and saying, let me try to get away with a little less here. And that, to me, is what we're missing in the story. And the final thing I'd say is that even if it was a matter of, in this particular case, saying that the man are more concerned about homosexuality than the raping of a woman, there are two parts of that. One is that it's the men deciding that, and let us not forget that. And secondly, that does not mean that just because this story is in the Bible that this is a moral lesson, that means that is right or wrong. The Bible is a collection of a lot of stories that are not of people making moral choices all the time. And so we should not interpret every story in the Bible to mean that the decisions that were made are the right decisions. I find it very disturbing to make those kind of considerations out of this kind of story.
I think what we're trying to do is trying to understand this position rather than make judgments of our own, because it is a story of distastefuls. They're all terribly distasteful, almost, you shudder to read them. But and maybe it's not a big point, but I keep thinking, here's this guy willing to give his daughter, and maybe cultural things have changed, but I can't believe a father's feelings toward his daughter have changed. And you try to understand, why would he be willing to give his daughter in place of that? And it just could be that in their mores, homosexuality was just so bad that he was willing to sacrifice his daughter.
Well, that's possible, and what I'm saying is that if that is the case, let us not assume then that's a moral statement. And I think that's what has happened to these two passages. I'm not sure that's the case. I think it's more of a matter of saying, my daughter and your concubine are less valuable than you are. And in terms of things, but if that was the case, I still think that the great danger is then to say that means that this man was making the right choice because this is written in the Bible. And I think that's a real misunderstanding of what the way we read the Bible.
You're saying that then to accept that as a precedent, that
that's
you
right.
put your, well, I certainly am not advocating that in any way, shape, or form, and I don't think many people would. What I'm just trying to say is what I believe they were saying at that time, what they believed.
Well, and isn't that in a sense what Brueggemann was saying? He wasn't saying that it didn't have anything to do with sexuality, but that we've blown that out of proportion to the whole picture. And that certainly there were the most heinous part of it was the very fact that they were going against God's will, period. They weren't living as God's people should live, whether it be sexually or hospitality-wise or in terms of relations, all the levels of relationship.
Can I just also say, and I'm part of this, there have been about two women. Here we are talking about the same thing that happened in inclusive language last night. The entire discussion decisions are being made by men about the role of women interpreted in the Bible here in this discussion. I'm just curious to know.
Harry, what do you women think?
I think both rape and homosexuality are wrong.
Wrong.
To me, the story just shows the depth of human sin, and I think another aspect of sin is that I think the rape is so horrendous, what they do to her, that it's almost too close to us to talk about. It's a little easier for us as a group to talk about homosexuality. I'm happily married woman, it seems far away from me, and I suspect if we were going to sit here and have a conversation about rape, it would be a very short conversation, because it's so violent. But I think in a sense maybe that shows our sin too. It's, we just can't look at the hard things of life. To me, that's the bigger issue. What happened to this woman?
Well taken. I mean, because I, you know, we know that in any group there are women who've experienced this similar, perhaps even been offered by their husband or father.
But I kept thinking about, you know, the statement of scripture, you know, father, you know how to good give good gifts to your children, how much more so? Well, God in heaven. Boy, that's out of touch that we don't. We are sinful. We don't know how to give good gifts to our children.
Wouldn't any woman here rather think that her father's sacrifice is helpful for her than to walk her west and put her out?
Did everybody hear that? You want to repeat that?
I said, wouldn't any woman here want to think that her father would love her enough to sacrifice himself for her and not say, okay, you can have my daughter, and I'll stay in the house and be safe? We all want to think that our fathers would put us first.
And he never does offer himself, he offers his.
What? I don't have a lot to say about it. I think that we're trying to apply today's values to something that's totally out of context of the way we feel today about women. I think in the context of this story, women were not human beings. They were possessions. And if a person, whether a man or a woman, could prevent a violent act against themselves by offering a chair or a glass of wine to someone else, they would do it. And I think that's the context of the story, not how they treated the women, because that's out of context with when the story was written.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad I live now, not there.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. We need to fully understand Scripture, we need to really look at what the cultural context was then and try to understand from that perspective. But not just stop with that. And I think that's what Tribble is saying too, and that it might be understandable somewhat since women were property then, but it doesn't mean that we can accept it or that it doesn't continue to happen in our time. And maybe that's what we need to learn most of all is this kind of thing still going on? And if so, what can we say about it? But yeah, you're right, we need to really.
I think we also need to keep in mind, and you know, maybe this is the point where we need to push on and look at the rest of the story, but I don't think we should assume that even what Judges is saying is that what happened is just fine. I mean, this whole event sparks a major war between Benjamin and the rest of Israel, precisely because of what these people have done to this woman. So let's not get caught in the idea of thinking that this story has got a big stamp of approval and it says that what's going on here is okay.
Yeah, I guess the comment made earlier about it and the role of God in this, I think we want to get to that. And I think this is a very important part of it as we look at our sinful nature and our lack of acknowledgement for God. And I think this is an example of that. If we look at Romans and where it acknowledges that man, in not acknowledging God and worshiping the creature, God gives that person up to that base society, that base acts, and it lists numerous wicked things, including men and the homosexuality, but also including women, specifically in Romans, the New Testament's explanation of this.
I think,
and I think that is the important thing. By not having that acknowledgement of God, these are some of the results of that. And when we include hospitality in that, that's true too.
I think, though, what Tribble would say about about Judges is this editor whoever wrote this stuff down is very liberal with saying this is good, this is bad, people were really bad, throws in a lot of editorial comments about, I mean, calling these guys base fellows and all that, saying that a lot of things were bad, and yet is strangely silent about how bad it was that the Levite offers his concubine, that the woman was abused in this way. I mean, there isn't enough, in my opinion, compared to all the condemnation that happens in the book of Judges for other things, there isn't enough speaking out against what was done to her. And the same thing with the story of Jephthah's daughter, which is in here also. There isn't a matter of saying this Jephthah shouldn't have killed his daughter. I mean, so I think that's what Kibble is trying to say, is that we need to read these stories and mourn them, and be willing to say that this shouldn't happen anymore. I mean, be willing to say what the narrator apparently is not willing.
But as the gentleman said, they get wiped out as a result of this. That's a fairly strong narrative, isn't it?
Well, the Levite is vindicated. I mean, the guy who's, we're gonna, we should go on here. I mean, he does not get wiped out for what he does. The Benjaminites do, but the Levite and the host here, nothing is ever said about them and what they did by throwing these women out in the street.
Now, there's a problem here that we're getting hung up. You know, the Old Testament is replete with this type of thing. But when Christ came, he said, it was said of old time. But I say, you know, things changed. And even then, of course, people were far from perfect. But to, I guess I just can't conceive of anybody using this as a stamp of approval for doing the same things as the people did back then. I mean, you could do anything you wanted then. After all, what about the story of Lot and his daughters?
Well, we should go on here. Time is hastening on, and it's going to get worse here. We need to finish the story. Does somebody want to read 27 to the end of the chapter? This is where the Levite really... Who wants to read?
And her master rose up in the morning, and when he opened the doors of the house and went out to go on his way, behold, there was his concubine lying at the door of the house with her hands on the threshold. He said to her, "Get up, let us be going." But there was no answer. Then he put her upon the ass, and the man rose up and went away to his home. And when he entered his house, he took a knife, and laying hold of his concubine, he divided her limb by limb into 12 pieces and sent her throughout all the territory of Israel. And all who saw it said, "Such a thing has never happened or been seen from the day that the people of Israel came up out of the land of Egypt until this day. Consider it, take counsel, and speak."
Maybe we should just finish it up by reading like 20... Okay, and this is the people's response, 20 verses, how about 4 to 7? This is kind of, I mean, all the people get assembled, they're all riled up, and they come to this guy and say, "Tell us how this wickedness was brought to pass." Would you just be willing to read 4 to 7 there?
And the Levite, the husband of the woman who was murdered, answered and said, "I came to Gibeah that belongs to Benjamin, I and my concubine, to spend the night. And the men of Gibeah rose against me and beset the house round about me by night. They meant to kill me, and they ravished my concubine, and she is dead. And I took my concubine and cut her in pieces and sent her throughout all the country of the inheritance of Israel, for they have committed abomination and wantonness in Israel. Behold, you people of Israel, all of you, give your advice and counsel here." Up to 9, did you say?
No, that's... Yeah. All right, so what do you think about this part?
She's dead when she's at the threshold, or she's alive?
Well, what do you think?
I think she was dead.
He explained it that way.
Obviously, she was dead. A few days' journey back to the time.
Was she dead at the threshold?
I don't think it is obvious that she was dead.
I mean, he says it is, but...
She didn't move.
After a couple days rise, he shows so much concern at the threshold. "Get up, come on, we're going."
Here's what Tribble says: "Arise and let us be going," but there was no answer. Is she dead or alive? The Greek Bible says, "For she was dead," and hence makes the men of Benjamin murderers as well as rapists and torturers. The Hebrew text, and that's our text here, on the other hand, is silent, allowing the interpretation that this abused woman is yet alive. Her silence, be it exhaustion or death, deters the master not at all. So I think it's deliberately ambiguous. It does not say in this text that she was dead.
Deters her, him from what?
It doesn't say that he put her body on his ass and went on his way. It says he put her upon the ass, meaning she might have been unconscious. We don't know. Or she might
be dead.
It does
say that she was dead when he cut her up.
No. He says that she was dead when he cut her up, but it doesn't say that she wasn't. In fact, some people in the first text that here said pointed out that the sort of laying hold of her in verse 29, that maybe there was some sense of struggle there. No, it, maybe she was dead, maybe she wasn't. The text is not clear.
By saying that she wasn't, you're trying to paint him worse than he ever was.
I'm not saying
that she was not dead when he cut her off, and we're trying to prove that he's worse than maybe he actually was.
Well,
and we were judging
time.
Him then, which is not right.
It's not right to judge him?
Well, that's the judge.
You're right. No, I'm not necessarily saying that she was alive. I'm saying we don't know. It says there was no answer, and that's all it says.
Right. Then we can assume she was dead.
Well, my pastor was always talking to the absence of anything else. I have to take it at face value. If the guy said she was dead, then I have to. But that's what's in the chapter.
Well, he also says, they, in verse 20, verse 5, the men of Gibeah rose against me, beset the house. They meant to kill me, and they ravaged my concubine, and she is dead. I mean, conveniently, he leaves out the fact, I gave them my concubine.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, so if you want to take what he says at face value, he's leaving out some other things, too, there.
The worst thing isn't whether she was dead or not. The worst thing is that he didn't pick her up and take her back in and take care of her. He just threw her on a donkey and left. I mean, whether she was alive or dead, the fact that he did that is so horrible.
It's not consistent with wanting to go and talk with her and be with her. And beginning, some things happened, but...
Oh, he's obviously scared for his own life.
Yeah.
He wants to get out of here.
Chapter 19 did not say that the men of the town wanted to kill him.
Right, so he added that in also. They sought to kill me. That's a good point. I know, it's so sad because here he missed her, obviously, at the beginning of the chapter. She left, he missed her, he wanted to go get her back. Something has changed here.
After what happened to her, I mean, he probably doesn't want to have anything to do with her anymore. So whether she was dead or not, to him, she was just as
good
as dead. I mean, after all the torture and rape and stuff she went through.
She was second hand in the road. Instead of having compassion and taking care of her, they're not worth anything. The beginning of chapter 19, I don't know if anybody else's translation has this or not, it's the New International Version. And it says, verse 2, that she had been unfaithful to him. And she left him and went back to her father's house. And his motivation for going to get her may not have been love and caring, but he may have been disgraced, and maybe he was going to bring her back to Tangier anyway.
So what do you have in verse 3? We have he went to speak kindly to her and bring her back.
Mine says he went to persuade her.
Yeah, they're in verse 2, the variant region, reading, we've got... His concubine became angry with him, but if you look at the footnote, the alternate is played the harlot against him. So there's either the translation of unfaithfulness or anger.
Do you think the cutting up in 12 is symbolic of the tribes?
Yes.
There's a parallel here, too, that just sort of shows how much women were considered to be property, and that is in 1 Samuel 11. Saul cuts an oxen into 12 pieces and sends it around in the same way to try to get people riled up. He took a yoke box, it doesn't say 12 here, cut them into pieces and sent them throughout all the territory of Israel with a message. I mean, it was certainly a way to get people's attention.
Didn't have any other significance, and if you got a piece of bloody meat, getting your attention?
Well, what would you suggest?
I don't know. I'm not a Hebrew.
what it did, I mean, the results are even sadder. Then what they did was they all went to war against the Benjaminites, their own people. They killed all of them except for 600 men. So they killed all the women. And then they decide, then they're sad. Then they realize, oh gosh, we can't let one of our tribes perish from the earth. What should we do now that we've killed all these Benjaminites except for these 600 men? They need wives. Where should we get some wives for them? So they decide they'll go against this other city, Jabesh-Gilead. They kill all the men there, all the married women and all the children, and just save out 400 virgins, give them to the Benjaminites for wives. And they still need 200 more wives, so they go and assault the women of Shiloh who are dancing out in the field and take them and give them to the other 200. So it really doesn't have a great ending.
Well, they were kind of discreet, killing women and children instead of the men, weren't they? A lot safer, wasn't it?
Anyway, obviously there was a lot of chaos reading the Book of Judges, but I think it is one of the saddest stories in Scripture, and there's a lot of sort of unresolved issues. Here's what Tribble says about it. Since it's almost 10 o'clock, I just want to read this. Couple passages here. She's building the whole thing around his quote where he cuts her up into pieces and then sends the message, direct your heart, take counsel, and speak. He's using her to get a message across to the others. And she picks up on that and says something to us about it. So if you'll permit me to just read a little bit here. Direct your heart to her, take counsel, and speak. From their ancient setting, these imperatives move into the present, challenging us to answer anew. Truly, to speak for this woman is to interpret against the narrator, the plot, the other characters, and the biblical tradition, because they have shown her neither compassion nor attention. When we direct our hearts to her, what counsel can we take? What word can we speak? What can we, the heirs of Israel, say in the presence of such unrelenting and unredeemed terror? First of all, we can recognize the contemporaneity of the story. Misogyny, that is, hatred of women, belongs to every age, including our own. Violence and vengeance are not just characteristics of a distant, pre-Christian past. They infect the community of the elect to this day. Woman as object is still captured, betrayed, raped, tortured, murdered, dismembered, and scattered. To take to heart this ancient story, then, is to confess its present reality. The story is alive, and all is not well. Beyond confession, we must take counsel to say never again. Yet this counsel is itself ineffectual unless we direct our hearts to that most uncompromising of all biblical commands, repent, repent.